You're listening to Politics Explained. Back to basics in the political sandpit with Rodney Hyde and Tane Webster.
Here on Rally Check Radio, it's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde, and it's welcome back to Tane Webster for Politics Explained, back to basics in the political sandpit. And remember, fire in your questions for us about politics, text us at 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Tane, what do you got for us this week?
Hey, Rodney. So this week, we've got some questions, well, something sent in by a supporter. So recently there was the Independent Electoral Review, and they put together their draft recommendations. The deadline closed on Monday, 17th of July, midnight, but we should still go through them anyway because there's some that are quite interesting. So I'm going to read off a few of the draft recommendations that I think the listeners might be interested in, and you might have some interesting comments on, and we'll just see what goes from there. So the first one I thought to highlight was recommendation number 4, requiring decision makers to give effect to the Treaty of Waitangi and its principles when exercising functions and powers under the Electoral Act. This obligation should apply generally across the Act and be explicitly included in the Electoral Commission's statutory objectives. Wow. What do you think of that?
Well, it's horrible. I mean, in practice, it should be nothing, because the treaty is all about being equal citizens and all having one vote. And you'd say, fine, fantastic, I love it. But of course, they're saying te tiriti, which has now been defined as co-governance. So what they're actually saying is that co-governance should be guiding our Electoral Commission. Oh, my goodness. So that's like a 50-50 power sharing or something at our electoral laws. Otherwise, why have it? Terrible idea, terrible, terrible, terrible thing. And, of course, both treaties, or the translation of the treaty into Maori from English and back again, same treaty. It's a complete myth that there are two separate treaties.
There's so much more we could say, but let's try and get through as many of these as possible. So the next one, recommendation number 6, this one is actually good, in my opinion, lowering the party vote threshold for list seat eligibility from 5% of the nationwide party vote to 3.5%. So, yeah.
Well, it's okay, but of course, what's the logic of 3.5 versus none or 5%? The reason that we have a cutoff point is to make for stable government, because in the limit you'd have a whole lot of independents that anyone wanting to form a government would have to get on side by basically buying them into supporting them as prime minister. So I believe in a limit if you're going to have MMP. I despise MMP, but if you're going to have MMP, you need a limit. 3.5%, whew, you might get a bit of a worry on. Because as you get more smaller parties in power, which we tend to think is a good thing, more diversity, you're also going to get more unstable government. Instability in government is a bad thing, even if you're an anarchist like me.
Yeah. Recommendation number 7, abolishing the one electorate seat threshold, provided the party vote threshold is lowered.
Yes, this is the idea, I believe, that if I won Epsom, I would, and had 2% of the vote, I'd get, say, 3 MPs. And so the 5% threshold doesn't apply. And it is an odd thing. So what it would mean is if I won Epsom and I was below 5%, you'd just get me. I think that's fair enough. Even that would have worked against me and my interests.
Next one, I thought this was interesting. Recommendation number 13, removing the mental incapacity as a ground to remove a member of parliament.
Yeah, that's a funny one, and it should go, really. Historically, it was the idea if someone went mad, you could remove them from parliament. I don't know if it's ever been exercised in the Westminster system where it derives from. And it is heinous if you think about it, that, you know, you'd have a doctor come along, or maybe two doctors, there'll be a test that someone worked out, and you say, no, that person can't be an MP because they're mentally incapacitated. In truth, you know, you could remove half the MPs under such a rule. The only argument would be about which half.
Yeah. This next one is a big one. Recommendation number 17, lowering the voting age to 16.
Terrible idea. You know, at 16, you're not contributing to society. You're not involved in society. You've got a lot of opinions. And, you know, 16-year-olds, we pretend, have a valid point of view. But in practice, they don't. You know, changes a lot when you get to 21. I'm not even in favour of 18. So the older you can make it in a funny way, the better, because you're more integrated into society. You're more understanding of what's at stake. I don't like that at all. It's really giving teachers the power to decide who the next government will be.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is.
Parrot what their teachers tell them, and they tell their parents that. It's a different world when you have a mortgage and a job and two kids.
Yeah, exactly. Which one should we go through next? Oh, recommendation number 22, granting all prisoners the right to vote.
I'm a little indifferent about that. In a way, yeah. I think if you're incarcerated, you do lose your rights to be part of society. And, you know, if you've committed a crime, you know, you're locked up, you're deprived of your freedom. Why should you have your right to vote? And how do you go if you're, say, an ACT MP or an ACT candidate? Do you literally go to your local prison on the promise that you'll lock them up for longer? How does that even work? Because there's a lot of votes in prisoners, make a difference. And so it's just going to have MPs going into a prison saying, vote for me and I'll get you out of prison. No, you're in prison because you've committed a crime against society and been found guilty by your peers, and you're deprived of your freedom, and I think you should be deprived of your vote. I mean, I don't really care too much about the vote at one level compared to my freedom. They were quite happy to lock them up, but, oh, they must vote. Well, they're going to vote to get out, right?
Yeah, yeah. This one's an interesting one. Recommendation number 40, enabling the preliminary count to be conducted electronically.
Bad idea. What's wrong with taking an extra bit of time and doing it manually, given the furore we had over electronic counting in the US? And whatever side you fall on, we shouldn't actually have that debate. You know, the idea of a machine doing it is open to hacking and fraud.
Yeah, yeah. This one's interesting. Recommendation 72, requiring the board of the Electoral Commission to have a balance of skills, knowledge, attributes, experience and expertise in the Treaty of Waitangi, Te Ao Māori and Tikanga Māori. I mean, this is kind of enforcing diversity of some
sort.
Well,
it's worse than that, because it's not saying you've got to be Māori. You've actually got to be steeped in Māori law. And ask yourself, what does Māori law have to offer an understanding of democracy in the Westminster system? None.
Recommendation 78, removing the ability for scrutineers to access marked copies of the electoral rolls which show who has voted during the voting period and to share this information with political parties and candidates.
It's terrible, because, you know, what you do is it's been a great mechanism for keeping it honest and getting people to vote. And so in the past, in electorates, particularly marginal electorates and first past the post, but even in MMP, and I used to do this in Epsom, is you'd have your supporters marking off people as they vote. You didn't know who they were voting for, but you often had a fair idea given their address, or, you know, you might have polled them or talked to them on the street and have them record that they're a supporter of you. And you would literally have people driving around the electorate helping people to the polling booth. Now, you can't talk to them about voting, but you can just help them get to the voting booth. And it's like a good thing, right? Little old lady, oh, Mrs. Brown didn't vote. Oh, well, we'll pop over and see if she needs help or whether she wants to vote. And we've got a car and we'll help her into the car and we'll get her down to the voting booth. I love that, sort of like a community thing. I don't think it's misused.
And number 96, extending the time frame for the offence of knowingly publishing false information to influence voters to include the entire advance voting period and polling day. So what is false information? I mean,
this is terrible, terrible stuff. And my personal and my very clear view, we should only have one polling day. And this idea that you can vote over a week or two is terrible because it creates this sort of problem. And this sort of problem is this, that on election day, you can't be electioneering. And I sort of get that. It's a huge effect on free speech. So you can't stand outside a polling booth and be yelling for people to vote Rodney Hyde or vote the ACT Party or vote Labour, because it would be sacrilegious to people going on and having a vote. They'd be being harangued, if you know what I mean. So we limit political free speech on the day of the vote, because if you didn't limit the free speech, it would become signs shoved in your face. Remember, vote for Rodney, remember, vote for this. No, no, no. All that just goes. And I accept that because it's a solemn day. All the election campaigning's been done. It's now over to the voters to decide. Now, I accept that there could be good reason that you can't vote for that day. And in the past, we've always allowed special votes. And that is because you're going overseas or you're on military action or active, or whatever. But you've got to have a reason. Nowadays, you can vote over a week or 2 weeks just because it suits you, right? It's easier because I'm driving home for work. I won't bother on today. And you don't get that special day feel. But now they're proposing that over that 2 weeks, my speech is going to be inhibited. My political speech is going to be inhibited by the government. And they're going to define what is false information. So I could be campaigning against vaccine mandates, climate change, gender ideology, and the government says, no, you can't do that for 2 weeks. And you're saying, well, this is the most important 2 weeks of the campaign. Shocking idea. Shocking, shocking, shocking. And but they'll, you know, they love the stuff. They love telling it what you know, even what you campaign on now is going to be decided by the government.
Yeah. We've gone through all of those quicker than I thought. So I've got one last question from Simon, who sent us a list a couple of weeks ago. So I thought we'd just finish off with that so we can tidy that off. He asks, when an individual becomes an MP or a candidate, so maybe there's two parts to this question, is there a pledge or oath that the individual must give? Who or what are the MP's loyalties owed to under the party structure, to the party or the citizens of New Zealand? Do the list MPs have any obligation to constituents when Parliament's not sitting? Parliament sits for 90 days. What do MPs do on non-sitting days?
It's a mix of questions. Well, there's no pledge, I believe, in most parties. I've never heard of a MP or a candidate having to take a pledge. And the reality is, once they get to Parliament, they're a free agent. And now there are consequences because of MMP and this waka jumping bill that you can be deemed to have left your party. And I hate that, and expelled from Parliament. But in fact, the parliamentary hierarchy, there's not much they can do to you absent that waka jumping bill. But with the waka jumping bill, we've seen what happens with that fellow from Hamilton, whose name I forget.
Sharma or something.
Yeah, who criticised the party and said that they were doing things wrong, and they decided that they would expel him from the party and therefore expel him from Parliament. In the old days, you could be expelled from a party, but you'd still be an MP. Because once you're elected an MP, our constitution was such that you were an MP for the period of that time, subject to mental incapacity. And I loved that because you could exercise, an MP could exercise their conscience and they could hold their own party to account. And we saw that many times with rebel MPs, including Winston Peters, stepping outside their party. Not possible under MMP. There was also a question about what MPs do. Well, it's a strange thing. MPs can pretty much do what they like. And good MPs work incredibly hard for their constituents, including list MPs. And bad MPs are the laziest people you've ever seen on God's earth.
Tell us a funny story of someone. Do you have any?
Ross Robertson is a great guy. And he was the MP for Papakura. I don't know what it would be called now. And he was a good, decent, old-time Labour MP. So he wasn't into the wokery and he wasn't into feminism and all the rest of it. He was a good bloke. And so Helen Clark and her little band hated her. And no one listening has probably heard of Ross Robertson unless they were in his electorate. So he was always pushed down, but he was always a happy, bubbly guy. He had the highest recognition rate of any MP in any electorate and was unbeatable. And even Helen Clark couldn't unseat him. And the reason is he was a great MP. But in particular, he'd walk up to you with a big grin, shake your hand, and he'd make you feel very special for having shaken your hand. And he'd spend his weekends visiting every sports field in his electorate. And he'd walk up one side of the footy field, shaking all the parents' hands and introducing himself, and down the other side, cross to the other field, hop in his car and drive off to another sports field where they'd be playing rugby. So everyone had met Ross Robertson and everyone voted for him because he was a great guy. And was that working? I guess it was, because his constituents felt they knew him, and if they had a problem, they felt they could go and see him. I loved it. I loved Ross Robertson. He was a great MP, and he worked extremely hard, and he was hated by the hierarchy, and even under MMP, they couldn't.
Yeah, we need more of that. We need a return to that. I remember, I think it was this year, one of the parties, they held an event, and it was basically private. But then the media was able to be there to film it, but the public weren't, and they were just to announce a policy or some sort. And
Simon Power was a minister, he had the seat of Rangitiki, and I can't remember where he lived, but he would be driven home in a ministerial limo, and he told me a great story that the limo would stop on. As it approached a town that they'd be driving through and go through the back streets. And he would walk down the main street shaking everyone's hand and walk through the town and get on the other side of the town and hop back into the limo. And he said he was taught that by his predecessor, who was an old-time MP. And he said the worst thing that you can do is drive through one of these provincial towns in a government limo and be seen in the limo, but also be seen not talking to people. John Carter was a fabulous MP up in Northland, and he and I travelled around his electorate one day, and he stopped. If he saw two people, he'd stop the car and get out and talk to them. And we were driving along, and we were pulled up by the noddy guy, you know, that has the stop-go sign, and John Carter's out of the car, shaking hands, talking to people, and they all knew him, and they all loved him. And I loved that about Parliament, but nowadays you'd have list MPs who'd walk past you in the street, or even local MPs, and you wouldn't know them. I struggle to name my local MP now.
Yeah, it's a different time, but it just shows how easy it would be to make a difference and stand out.
Particularly in your electorate. And then the other thing that's interesting is when I became an electorate MP in Epsom, even after two terms, I had had literally 13,000 people contact my office and interact with my office. And it might be over something quite trivial that they'd need help with, but it's amazing, you know, that people come to you, and if they get a good service, and it might be they just need something pushed along or something even signed by their local MP, who's a figure of some note that's a public figure, they remember that. And if you give them the brush off, they remember that too. And I love that about democracy. I loved it one time when Michael Cullen was the Minister of Finance, and he's a big deal and everyone's nodding their head to him and pleased to get 5 minutes of his time. And then the election was called and I saw him in the street handing out pamphlets, begging for the vote. And it's a fabulous thing, because he had to get off the high horse every 3 years, knock on doors, walk down the street and ask people for their vote. It's humbling. And they get the opportunity to tell you what they think, and you actually have to listen. And it's a very powerful thing. And I learned that campaigning in the electorate. My competitor, Richard Worth, who lost the seat, I would be walking down the street chatting to people, and he would drive past in his big SUV with loudspeakers screaming, "Vote for Richard Worth, vote for Richard Worth." And I'd be sitting there talking to a couple of old dears, and you can imagine the effect it had on them. And I'd always joke, you know, "Who's that fella?" But you were talking to them, but more particularly, you were listening to them. You just listen. You'd be humble compared to the guy driving down the road screaming at them out of a loudspeaker, which, if you think about it, is very rude.
As the situation deteriorates, it will be harder and harder for politicians to fake that caringness, and so there's going to be a gap for genuine people, I think, in the coming years.
I think that's true. And of course, you know, 40 years ago, the National Party had 250,000 members. And in order to be a candidate for the National Party or the Labour Party, you actually had to be a genuine person. You had to be able to, they knew you. And they had a lot of choice of who they could put up as a candidate. And you didn't just waltz in. Now you sort of waltz in, you've been to university, you've got a job in Parliament, you decide to stand, and you've actually never been out in what we would call the real world or interacting with people, and you have no empathy. Helen Clark had no empathy with working people. It was so evident. She'd never been around them.
All right. That's enough for the one.
There you
episode.
Go. That was Tane Webster. You've been on Politics Explained, Back to Basics in the Political Sandpit. If you've got a question, send it to us and Tane will drop it on me. Sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong, but we sort of do it on the spur, so it's not, as Chris Hipkins would say, pre-formulate my answer. Send us a text, 2057, or send me us an email, inbox@realitycheck.radio. Tane, talk next week.
See you later.
You're listening to Politics Explained, Back to Basics in the Political Sandpit with Rodney Hyde and Tane Webster.